Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. TBI, traumatic brain injury. It's been all over the news recently, and we tend to think of soldiers returning from war and football players who have had one too many blows to the head during practice and play as the recipients of this often life-threatening and always debilitating injury. Back in May, I spoke with Bruce Barcott, whose article for Bicycling Magazine, Senseless, told of what is happening with helmet research. Now, in his December article for Outside Magazine, After the Crash, A Closer Look at the Rising Incidence of Brain Injury, journalist Mark Percuzzi states, quote, a report funded by the City of New York found that brain injuries are responsible for 74% of cycling deaths nationwide. According to the American Association of Neurological Surgeons, roughly 600 cyclists die annually as a result of head injuries, and in 2009, some 85,000 concussed cyclists ended up in emergency rooms. Mark is a contributing editor for Outside, the editorial director of Mountain Magazine, and the former editor-in-chief of Skiing Magazine. He's been an Outside contributor since 1999. He's also a backcountry skier, endurance mountain bike racer, and recreational road biker. Mark and I are going to delve into the science and research that is being done to help cope with the issue of TBI, as well as why human beings may not be ready for the kinds of risks we seem to be so willing and so casually to take. We'll discuss that and a lot more when I speak with Mark in a moment. After a short break and some news, we're going to talk with Ed Dunn about his company VeloBling. I always look for clever gifts when I go to Interbike, and besides an eye-catching logo, a shiny wine stopper grabbed my attention, and so I had to take a look. We'll talk about that item and some of the other recycled gift ideas from VeloBling. And then, last but not least, we'll head on up to Detroit, Michigan to speak with race announcer, competitive cyclist, and author Jamie Smith. His new book, Reading the Race, co-written with champion veteran rider Chris Horner, offers a treasure trove of information about everything from motivation to pack riding to choosing your team and teammates. Chris Horner's chapter add-ons are fun and interesting and insightful. So let's head on out to Boulder, Colorado to speak with Outside Magazine contributing editor Mark Percuzzi and find out what happens to your head after a crash. Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining me on The Outspoken Cyclist.
Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. Well, not too long ago, we talked with Bruce Barcott. He wrote an article for Bicycling Magazine called Senseless, Helmets and Safety, and really talked a lot about helmet research, what's going on. This week, I read your article, After the Crash, A Closer Look at the Rising Incidence of Brain Injury, and it's for the December issue of Outside Magazine. It gives us a much different and more in-depth look at traumatic brain injury and how sport has changed over the past 20 years. So tell us what has changed about sport, especially skiing and biking, because that's pretty much what we cover here.
Yeah, there have been big changes, and kind of what was left out of Bruce's tremendous article is that is what we did as end users, and we've changed our behavior dramatically over the last 10 to 15 years. And in biking, it's pretty obvious. I moved to Boulder, Colorado about 12 years ago. When I moved here, you could get out for one or two high-intensity group rides a week. Nowadays, this past summer, I could have ridden my bike at a high intensity in a Peloton with as many as 70 riders on every single day of the week, and sometimes twice. So we're riding bikes faster, and the same thing with skiing. We're skiing faster. Part of this is technology-based, especially with skiing and mountain biking and snowboarding, for that matter. In those sports, we have rockered skis, meaning they're upturned at the tip and tail. Same with snowboards. You can take them off groomed runs and ski really fast. It gives you much more of a surfy feel, and you can throw the skis sideways, and they're really loose and fun. On the mountain biking side, we have long travel mountain bikes with big disc brakes on them. They're, you know, we used to have 25-pound bike was a cross-country race bike with a little bit of travel. Now a 25-pound bike has 6 inches of travel. They climb beautifully. You get to the top of a big backcountry trail and turn around, and you're essentially riding at downhill mountain biking speeds. But downhill mountain biking used to be done at a resort, and you had full body armor and a full-face helmet, and there was a bike patroller there and an ambulance nearby. But now we're doing these things way out in the backcountry and just going really fast on skis and on bikes.
Well, you also talk in your article about what's happened with halfpipe as a good example of how things have changed in terms of technology in the sport itself, not necessarily the person. We're going to get to the evolution of the person here, but talk to us about what happened in halfpipe, because I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah. The first halfpipes in snow were essentially ditches. They were 4 feet deep at the most, and the walls weren't even close to vertical. And if you had a fall in there on a spring day with your T-shirt on, you probably got a raspberry, and that was about it. But they progressed rapidly. They went from 4 feet to 8 feet to 12 to 18 in the 1990s. And the new standard today, which is adopted in 2010 by the Olympic Organizing Committee, is called a super pipe. It's 22 feet tall or deep, and it's the walls are vertical. So when these elite athletes sail out of that pipe, they're catching nearly 25 feet of air above the lip. So at the apex of their jumps, they're somewhere in the neighborhood of 47 feet off the ground. And the ground isn't soft snow as it might appear on TV. These things are so polished by big pieces of grooming equipment that it's essentially white ice. So when they fall from that height and make a very small mistake, the margins are tight. There's about a 2.5 foot wide window transition to land on. If you fall all the way to the deck, obviously the gravity just takes complete control, and you stack on the deck. And then if you get caught halfway and hit that lip, you can have a pretty devastating hit. You might visually remember seeing Shaun White bounce his head off of the lip of the halfpipe in the Vancouver Olympic Games in a warm-up run.
It's terrifying, actually, to me, you know, that people are willing to take those kind of risks, which is another whole part of this issue. So besides the better equipment, which obviously we have, the more intense, for this example, halfpipes, you know, for competition, what has happened to people? There is a comment you make about the body's evolution hasn't gone as fast. And so I think you say our equipment has gotten better, but human evolution and biology is not keeping up. What did you mean by that, and how do you sort of, you know, dovetail that into the whole issue with TBI?
Yeah, that was actually a quote by the father of free skiing, Mike Douglas. He lives up in Whistler, BC, and he's also a passionate mountain biker. But essentially the idea behind that is, like, look, we're traveling at these greater velocities, we're getting more and more hang time, and then when things go wrong, we're hitting the ground or hitting objects really hard, and the brain just cannot handle these types of hits. And I like to make an analogy. I didn't do it in the article, about your helmet is your automobile, and your brain is your body. Now, in a crash, the front of your car crumples up. That's how they've been designed to absorb impact.
Right.
Same thing with your helmet. But in a car, you're strapped in with a seatbelt, and an airbag explodes in front of you and stops you. But that stopping action doesn't happen with the brain. When we hit really hard, the brain moves forward through the fluid in the head and smashes off of the front of the skull cavity, twisting as it does so. And then it will rebound off, if the hit is big enough, it will rebound off that wall and then hit the back wall of the skull. And the damage that's done to the brain, more and more we realize it's permanent. It's not like a blown ACL or or a broken leg. It doesn't heal perfectly over time. What you have to train new areas of the brain to compensate, and that's kind of what we're getting at. We're overpowering our helmets, and we're moving beyond what the body can handle.
Well, you actually say in your article that you were familiar with the phenomenon, that you rode your bike perilously fast through dense woods and ski down steep couloirs where falling could be fatal, and that you suffered one bike crash that left you nauseous with a cracked helmet and a lump on your head, and another that shattered your collarbone. So this brings me to the whole idea of having that sense that you need to push those limits. And I'm wondering, do those limits start getting pushed early in life by parents and coaches? Or what's happening to people that they feel that they need to go faster and harder and steeper and whatever else you do out there?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, and it's true. I have had that bike crashes, and the purpose of this article is by no means to steer people away from riding bikes or skiing or snowboarding. It's to pull back and think about where a fall will take you, at what speeds, what type of objects you might hit, and to ski or bike within your limits a little bit more. But as far as what's changing, especially on the fringe of the sport, on the extreme elite end of the sports, as we moved away from timed events like a downhill racing or slalom or even a time trial on a bike, and moved into more freestyle type events that are judged on objective and subjective factors, people push this word, and you'll hear it ad nauseum at the upcoming Olympic Games, called progression. To win, you have to do something new. And to do something new, you need essentially to catch more air and carry more speed into a jump and add that one more rotation, that fourth flip possibly. And as we kind of push these limits of the body, we end up having these really devastating crashes. And I think I don't want to single out the more extremes X game style athletes either, because as recreation athletes, even the peloton full of 35 to 45 year olds on a Wednesday evening ride, people are taking their training incredibly seriously. They're hiring personal coaches. They're riding harder and longer and getting out more often. And, you know, I see it here in town. I've pulled a number of people out of ditches on these big group rides, and I've had my share of crashes as well. So we're riding at essentially Tour de France speeds, but we don't have the luxury of a sag wagon, and the road's open to traffic, and people touch wheels and they go flying into the ditch. And it's all in this pursuit of the beautiful joy of going fast on a bike or going fast on skis, but the consequences have been kind of ignored by a lot of us on a recreational level.
I'm talking with Mark Peruzzi. He is with Outside Magazine. His new article is titled, it's in the December issue, by the way. It's titled, After the Crash, A Closer Look at the Rising Incidence of Brain Injury. And one of the things I would also like to talk about was a study that I think her name is Christy Leskinen. Leskinen of free skiers. And she found there was this difference between men and women, and yet these event sponsors do not seem to. They said something to her that was very disturbing to me. Do you want to discuss that?
Oh, sure. She, Christy, was a contemporary of Mike Douglas, so she was one of the first women free skiers. Or you think of the half-pipe skier and the slope-style skier, kind of going off big air jumps and doing a lot of maneuvers in the air. And as she watched these features get bigger and bigger, the half-pipe get deeper and the jumps get bigger, she started seeing more and more people getting injured. So a few years ago, she surveyed 90 professional-level free skiers and snowboarders, and gave them an anonymous survey about what they thought about jump size and speeds and safety. And what she found was that most of the women that she surveyed privately wanted to see smaller jumps. Women were getting hurt at higher rates than the men were, simply because of some basic physics about mass and how far they can get their bodies off the ground in a similar jump. And she presented her findings to her coaches and to the free skiing community and freestyle snowboarding community, and she was summarily ignored, which is kind of a strange thought. But they told her flat out that if women wanted smaller jumps, that they wouldn't get the sponsors that the men got, and that their careers would be hurt because of it.
And they would be paid less money.
Yeah, they would be paid less money, and her career specifically would be hurt, and that women free skiers in general wouldn't make as much money. And as a result, nothing has changed. And today, as we go into the Olympic Games, women will be going off of the same size features that the men will.
I find that to be unconscionable, personally. What's the difference if we make the jump a little smaller? At least it works for women, and women still put on a great show. That just doesn't make any sense to me. You know, fewer sponsors and less money. It makes me more than upset. It makes me angry. But you can understand why. So let's talk a little bit about what happens to the brain when you hit your head and you have a traumatic brain injury, that these brown little balls start forming, but nobody has been able to find them so far until autopsy. There's a neurosurgeon in Chicago by the name of Julian Bales who works with a Sports Concussion Institute. So explain what he does and what CTE is and what those little brown balls are that they find on autopsy.
Yeah, that's right. You might have heard of CTE and all the news that's coming out of the NFL. And much of the articles focus on TBI, traumatic brain injuries, and more on the severe end of the scale. But CTE is something that happens from concussions, multiple concussions. And what happens is the brain, essentially like a jello mold inside of your head, and in a fairly severe fall and a concussion, the brain shifts forward or into the skull wall, depending on how you fall, and then it rebounds back. And in that, during that trauma, the brain actually takes a hit, and the neurons take a hit, but especially the axons, which are, think of them as kind of the fiber inside of your brain, the messenger inside of the brain that moves information from cell to cell throughout your entire body. When a neuron is stretched or sheared, it ruptures, and into that rupture, some proteins form, and these little brown balls of protein. It's some scar tissue, essentially the way the body is trying to heal itself. But that buildup ends up blocking those lines of communication, and they're still learning a lot about this, obviously, but in the long run, they've tied CTE to things like dementia and Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's, things that long-term debilitations of the brain. And I asked Dr. Bales how many concussions an athlete could safely take. And the subconcussive blows, the kind where in a football game that kind of constant helmet-to-helmet hit, that could be hundreds if not thousands of hits over the course of a football player's career. But as far as concussions go, the ones that would take you out of the game, or if you were a skier or a cyclist, the kind that might lead you to walk to an emergency room or go ask some friends and family for help. That type of concussion, you can safely sustain three in the course of your life before they think you're going to do this type of long-term damage. And that's not to say that everybody who has three concussions is going to end up with dementia, but the more they learn about it, the more they realize that there are no safe number of concussions that you can sustain.
Has anybody done any research on all of the concussed cyclist? I know there is some ridiculous number that you actually talk about in your article, that roughly 600 cyclists die annually as a result of head injuries. And that was in and then in 2009, 85,000 concussed cyclists end up in emergency rooms. That's a huge number, 85,000.
Yeah, it's a massive number, but also you have to remember that that includes everybody from kids who sadly don't wear helmets or adults who don't wear helmets, but it also includes people who are enthusiasts, people who ride bikes with helmets on and crash. Is very much like a snowboarder. When they fall, they tend to fall really quickly as they catch an edge, and they can't spread their legs to absorb any of the forces. They fall quickly and hit their head hard. Similar on a bike, when you fall off a bike, you might put your arm out, but your head is very much exposed. Your feet are kind of out of the action, as they're usually behind you.
Do you know if this is a bigger problem in the United States than it is in other countries? And maybe you don't. It just occurred to me, when you think about cyclists in Europe, very few wear helmets unless they're racing.
Yeah, and that's not actually a line of reporting that I did, but one kind of disturbing trend that I've seen, and it's also not in the article and it's hard to get a handle on it, is as bike commuting and has become more popular, you start to see people on these kind of fixed gear bikes with skinny jeans, and then you've got the cruiser bike crowd and women in dresses and looking wonderful, and I'm fully supportive of more people riding bikes, but you're seeing fewer of those people wearing helmets because of style issues, and I think it's something that needs to be addressed in the future.
It is an interesting point. And I'm not one to say, well, you should wear a helmet, but I think that statistics will show that when you hit your head, a helmet can help. Did you come to conclusions when you were writing this? You know, you ran the gamut from a woman who, you actually began the article with a woman named Sally Franklin, who actually was not an super experienced skier, and who took a chance that, to me, I probably would never have even stood at 10,500 feet, let alone jump off of whatever she jumped off of and ended up with this horrible injury. All the way down to, you know, guys coming back from the service. What do you think is going to happen research-wise going forward? You've looked at a lot of the different research.
Yeah, I think going forward, people will have a much clearer understanding of the risks that they face and kind of getting to that point before that. There's no level of concussion that is safe, and we need to make better decisions whether we're skiing into a big backcountry couloir. Maybe we should wait another couple of years and get some more experience under our belt before we make a decision like that, or if it's even just on a group bike ride, trying to figure out how if you're running a bike ride with a bunch of recreational athletes, maybe start thinking about routes that are safer to keep people away from cars, and talk about when to go fast and when not to go fast, and just making better decisions straight through. In the article, I talk about my son, who's 12 years old, and took a mountain bike camp up at on a downhill mountain bike resort, and before he went, I kind of read him the Riot Act, and he made really good decisions that day. But the one thing that didn't work out is his coach kind of pushed him to take a line that he wasn't ready for. And I think parents of children need to talk to the coaches and the people that they're recreating with, and push them on these issues and talk about safety with them. And then the last thing we need to do is we need to start pushing helmet manufacturers to make safer helmets, because most of the high-end bike helmets, especially that you might have purchased over the last 10 or 15 years, a lot of people are buying those based on weight, because cycling is a strength-to-weight sport. And
well, it's styling. Also the cool factor, you know.
Yeah, styling. But people aren't asking the hard questions about safety of helmet manufacturers, and the more people start buying helmets based on safety, the faster we'll get better helmets on the market.
Well, I'm not sure the testing organizations, CPSC, ASTM, are actually pushing for better technology. They're sort of passing these helmets as being safe up to a point, you know, but nobody drops the helmet on a an anvil, you know, from 14 feet. That's not how we fall down.
Yeah, that's true. And ASTM, to their in their defense, they're doing everything they can as a testing laboratory to push these issues. They want to see that they're working on a rotational test. They have a low velocity test coming out shortly. But the consumer protection agencies, they need to step up their game a little bit, because and this is another note that we actually didn't have space for in the article, but take a youth helmet, for example. It's tested at the same levels that an adult helmet is, but a youth helmet is smaller. So to make it pass the adult test, they have to stiffen up all that EPS foam, which means that it takes a tremendous amount of force to get the foam to start to splinter, deform, and crack, which means that your kid is wearing a helmet that's even built for higher velocity hits technically than you are.
And your brain can move around more because it's not being stopped as quickly. There's not as much saving the impact or mitigating the impact is what you're saying.
Yeah. That.
And wow.
And children, especially young children, their brains are developing, and
sure.
And we need to protect their brains.
Well, I have one more question, and it wasn't in anything I sent you, but I did read the article, and I reported on this earlier. How is Dale Stetina doing?
The last I checked, he's still improving. His brother has been reporting some updates on Facebook. He obviously has a long way to go.
Right.
But
right.
And he's now the sixth person that I know at least loosely, who suffered a severe TBI. But his spirits are good from what I understand, and he's looking forward to getting back on a bike at some point.
You wonder how some people get back on the horse, you know. But
yeah.
I mean, he comes from a cycling dynasty, so I can see that he would be itching to get back on. Well, we wish him a lot of good luck. And Mark, thank you so much for taking time. I know it's pre-holiday Thanksgiving. I hope you have a nice holiday. And the article, again, is in the December issue of Outside Magazine. It's titled After the Crash, A Closer Look at the Rising Incidence of Brain Injury. Fascinating article. I think anybody who rides on the road, who skis, who rides a mountain bike might want to take a look at it. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
All righty. Bye-bye. Mark Peruzzi joined me from his home in Boulder, Colorado. Traumatic brain injury. What a topic. It's an excellent article. It's in the December issue of Outside Magazine. I highly recommend it. I'm going to take a short break on The Outspoken Cyclist, and I'll be right back.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
On Monday, December 9th, from 6 to 9 p.m., the Northeast Ohio Cycling Community, with support from The Outspoken Cyclist, is hosting a fundraiser for the Cleveland Food Bank at La Taqueria on Wilson Mills Road in Highland Heights, featuring food, beverages, and a silent auction. All event proceeds will go to support the Cleveland Food Bank. Ticket holders are also asked to bring two non-perishable food items for donation. Ticket and more information at OutspokenCyclist.com or at SignMeUp.com. Search for Cleveland, Ohio events.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. I'm going to head on out to Denver, Colorado to speak with the owner of VeloBling, Ed Dunn. Ed, thank you for joining me on the show this evening.
Well, thank you.
It's my pleasure. So, you know, I went shopping at Interbike, came across your booth, and I loved the name VeloBling and your logo, which is very clever. And then I began looking around at your product offerings. So tell me a little bit about the premise of VeloBling. What is your company? What is it that you do?
Well, VeloBling is, you know, we do jewelry and accessories all made from recycled bicycle parts. And it all started with me looking for some bicycle-style jewelry for myself and just... numerous searches on the internet and all that, I really didn't come across anything I like. So I just created a bracelet for myself out of an old chain, started wearing it around on bike rides, whatever, and just had buddies starting to ask me where I got it. And that's kind of when the light bulb kind of like, well, I might have something here.
Yeah, the necessity being the mother of invention, right. Very cool.
And then my wife, Margaret, said, hey, women wear jewelry too.
So you think?
She started making pieces, you know, for women. And then we started out just doing some local art festivals, and the interest was just huge. So we thought, you know, let's bring this product to the bigger market. So we went full speed ahead. I left my day job and started attending all the big trade shows.
So how did you come up with the name VeloBling?
So VeloBling, you know, I thought of, I had so many names going through my brain. Velo meaning is French for bike.
Right.
And then bling, well, I think everybody can relate to the bling.
Yeah, I think so.
It. So it's like, you know, bike bling.
Right. Exactly. So the one thing that stopped me really in my tracks was your wine stopper. It was so cool the way you had the display. And I just had to know what it was. And that's really what made me stop and come into your booth. So you have all kinds of products. Are they all recycled bike parts?
They are. Everything is from chains or brake rotors. The only parts that are not recycled are anything with a spoke nipple, just because the spoke nipples are so kind of beat to hell. But everything else is recycled.
So what are your best-selling items?
There's so many pieces in kind of each category, whether it's necklaces, you know, just for example, in necklaces we have the inverted triangle, and it's recycled chain. We use the inside links of that, and it comes in three options in terms of the mixed media metal part of it, which is bronze, copper, or aluminum. And then what's cool with that piece is actually the neck cord is the derailleur cable or shifter cable.
Wow. Well, if you go to your website, it has so many categories. You have regular jewelry, men's jewelry, home decor, and accessories. I'm going to scroll down here. I get the option of having this wonderful computer in the studio. And it's just really pretty stuff. You have clocks. You have a lot of clocks. But explain the wine stopper, because that was the thing that got me. I really loved it.
So the wine stopper, I always say that's for your second bottle, maybe your third bottle, because it's pretty useless for your first bottle.
Okay, that's anyways, a good one.
Yeah, it's a chrome-plated stopper, and it has a vertical shaft on it, and that shaft comes in, you know, kind of two different options. There's we use hand-blown glass beads, which we work with some other artists. So the beads, that colorful beads, are all hand-blown. And then there's also metal pewter beads. And then there's three chain links on the shaft. So all the chain is recycled.
Well, it's very cool. And one of the features you offer on your website is Recycle With Us. There's a page called Recycle With Us. What is that all about? How does that work?
So we want to work, you know, we work with whatever shop, bicycle shop, that wants to participate. It's pretty simple. They just send us a request, and we get their information, and they just tell us basically the size of the box and the weight, and then we just email them a UPS, FedEx, or USPS shipping label, whatever is convenient for them. And they just print it out, slap it on the box, and ship it off to us.
So are you only offering your products through bike shops, or is there also an online store?
No, it's an online store, of course, on the internet at velobling.com.
Okay.
And also, we probably have 125-ish accounts nationwide.
Nice.
From the U.S., Canada, and we just have a few current ones in Japan.
Wow.
And it's not only bike shops. You know, it's women's boutique shops. It's your kind of sporting goods stores and gift shops.
You've actually branched out from just the bicycle industry. So people buy this jewelry, for example, or home decor stuff, who may or may not be into cycling. They just like what they see.
Correct. Yeah.
Interesting.
And a lot of the pieces are pretty, even though it's, you know, obvious bike chain, we get a lot of response that people don't realize it's bike chain.
Very interesting.
Just because it's kind of sleek and not real bulky looking.
Without giving us exact pricing, can you give me sort of a range of what items might cost, like as little as or as much as, somewhere in there?
As little as, you know, $8. You know, I'd probably say the average, anywhere from $25 to $35.
So these would be $40. Nice gifts for the holidays. And that's why we contacted you, because we like to feature, you know, a company who's got some interesting gifts for cyclists especially. But it's nice to know that other people are, like, embracing cycling recycled stuff that may or may not even be into biking. I think that's kind of cool.
Right, right. And everything is, you know, everything's handmade here in Denver. So it's all, you know, made in the USA.
Cool.
Handmade in Colorado.
Well, velobling.com. I love the name. Again, if you want to go see what Ed's got out there, it's right out there on the website.
Right.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with me about Velobling and about your products and about USA made. I'm all into that. And I hope you have a great season. We'll probably see you at Interbike next year, huh?
We will be there.
All right. Thanks so much.
Right. Thanks again.
Bye-bye. Ed Dunn joined me from his offices in Denver, Colorado. I really did like the Wine Stoppers. They did actually stop me in my tracks. That is how I found Ed and his company. So it's velobling.com. So now we're going to go not too far from home. We're going to head up to Detroit, Michigan, and we're going to speak with racer and race announcer Jamie Smith about his new book, Reading the Race. Jamie, thanks for talking with me this evening.
Thanks for having me, Diane. Pleasure to be here.
Well, you're not too far from me. We're only about 3 hours apart.
3 hours apart and about 20 degrees colder.
Why? What's it doing down up there?
We're in the 30s up here now.
We're not. We're freezing. Oh, well, actually, I think we're in the 40s. We're not that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's cold here. It's gray. It's Cleveland, you know.
Yeah.
So we are going to talk about your book, Reading the Race, which has just been published by VeloPress. But let's back up, and I want to talk about you and your history in the sport of bike racing. When did you begin racing?
I started racing when I was in the Air Force. Would have been in 1981, 82. Is when I got my first real racing bike and entered my first race.
Yeah, it's addictive, isn't it?
Oh, gosh, yes. And from then on, I mean, it's been like a very bad cold that I can't shake.
Yeah, I know how that goes. So
yeah.
So you transitioned from racing to announcing, but not really. It's not like you stopped racing. When did you start doing race announcing? Because that's kind of an art.
I got out of the Air Force, went to college, and studied radio. And the two things combined to, you know, it was a perfect storm of being a bike racer and someone who could pick up a microphone and talk. And it would have been in 1985, 86, my bike club put on a bike race, and they said, hey, we need someone to talk. Oh, Jamie, here, you do it, because you talk a lot. And it's just kind of a natural progression of being a broadcasting student and a bike racer. It just was a perfect fit. And then Event Services, which was a company out of Denver, Colorado, and they used to do all of the tech support for races, they came to town, and I saw Brian Drebber and Jeff Rope working the event, and that I knew right then that's what I wanted to do. So for me, it wasn't that big of a stretch, because I was, you know, into both things equally.
Do you make any money announce racing? I mean, well, if you're Phil Liggett, I guess you do, but
yeah, if you're Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin and those
Bob
guys,
Roll, yeah,
Bob Roll, I made more money announcing than I ever did racing. So if I'm going to spend a day at a bike race, I might as well be guaranteed the money. But I never did it for the money, because I had a second job. I had a real job, and that allowed me the flexibility to go away on the weekends and be an announcer. I did it more just because I loved the sport, and, you know, it kind of fed my ego at the time, whatever that's worth. But I just loved talking about bike racing, and loved the, you know, having my travel paid for and being able to go all over the country and meet people and talk about bike racing was kind of fun. Now there are guys that do it full time as a living, and they eke out, you know, it's a living wage, depending on what your lifestyle is. You can do it, But what happened with me, I did it for about 10 years at a full, you know, what I say full bore, from almost every weekend from April till October. And this would have been from 87 to about 96. Every weekend, that you get burned out on either the travel or talking about basically the same thing all the time. And you almost become like the tour guide at Universal Studios. So the first couple of years, I'd be on the microphone, I'd say, all right, this is a breakaway. It's four guys from different teams working together, using the synergy of the sport. And I'd be all excited about talking about it like this. And then after a couple of years, it's like, that's four guys working together. It's the synergy of the sport. And, you know.
I got it.
Yeah, save your tickets, because that's an additional 10% off at the gift shop. So it's, you know, it's just... That was a long answer to a very short question. You can make money off of it.
Well, but so as much as you liked announcing, you say that you are more at home in the middle of a fast-moving Peloton.
No, no question. Yeah.
So what is it about being in the middle of a fast-moving Peloton that's so compelling? To me, it's like terrifying.
It's like being in a plane crash. No, it's like being in a I think it's referred to it in the book, in a tornado of bikes and bodies and yeah, it's once you get over the panic of being elbow to elbow and flying down the road, and the, you know, the specter of a crash is always right there. Once you get over that, then you have the next level of, okay, now I'm going to make this bike go fast, and all my training has gone into it. And then beyond that, it's my team against the next team and against the individuals. And on so many, it's like three-dimensional chess. It's like so many things working at once. And, you know, I don't worry about crashing. I've crashed, you know, enough times. It's just a combination of all of it. It's just, it's hard to explain. It's, there are other sports that I play, and they all have addictions, but this one, it just appeals to my sports personality. I like the rush forward in a stampede. You know, I don't know, let's not analyze that too much. Maybe it goes back into my ancestors.
Well, at least you're not like being chased by bulls, you know.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Right. And I'm not going to be, well, I could be gored. But,
I guess, but that's a whole different story.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your book a little bit since,
okay, sure.
You know, okay. So it's called Reading the Race.
Yeah.
What does Reading the Race mean?
Well, you know, it's once you're in the race, and there's all those things that are going on all those different levels, you have to figure out what is happening now and what's going to happen in the future and how does now, you know, in the first, let's say, first five laps of a race, what's happening and how is that going to, what's coming next? And reading the race means you're aware of all the possibilities, you're seeing, you know, who's tired, who's attacking, who's doing what, and you're reading it as a big picture, trying to sort out what the next picture is going to be. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It absolutely makes sense.
Yeah.
I understand what you're saying. So how did you... Go ahead. I was going to just ask how you got hooked up with Chris Horner to do this book.
You know, talk about people who can read a race. He's one of the guys who really has an eye for doing that. And he can... A very strategic eye, where a lot of riders, and I can't name names, but they rely on the director sportif, or they rely on what they're being told to do. And Chris is one of those guys that, while he's rolling down the road, can do it. Now... I didn't handpick him. When Velo Press first mentioned that they wanted to put a pro rider with it to look at that professional viewpoint and, you know, kind of add credibility, my name flashed to Frankie Andreo first, because I've known Frankie a long time. He's raced locally here in the Detroit area. He's just been around the sport forever, and now he's a manager of 5-Hour Kenda. But he didn't have any interest and didn't have time to do it. And Chris was my second choice, and it was a conversation that I had with Velo Press. And why him and not what any of the other pros? Chris has all the, you know, Chris raced, you know, has done it all. He's raced in Europe, yes, but he also raced, you know, dominated when he was with Saturn and Webcor and Mercury and you know, slept in his car and lived that whole American roadie thing. And again, and has the reputation of being a good, you know, reader of races. So,
well, his addition to the book is interesting because each chapter, there seems to be a small piece written by Chris Horner, and it's sort of anecdotal. At the same time, it's giving you ways of learning. So yeah. The book covers a whole lot of stuff. So one of the things that I'd like you to discuss is the pinpointing of a couple of areas like most riders get hung up on when they first start racing. So a Cat 5 rolls up to the line for the first time and goes, uh-oh. What happens to that person that maybe by the time he becomes a Cat 3, you know, is no longer a problem?
Oh, what the first thing they're afraid of is crashing and running into riders, you know, going down. And that's the biggest fear that most riders face as a Cat 5, rightly so, because there's so many levels of ability coming to the line at that time, and none of them have the experience of traveling in a pack. And then they're more concerned with, you know, like if you go into a message board, the one that I frequent a lot is bikeforums.net is where I just kind of got a feel for how the cycling community, you know, beyond my friends, beyond the people that I actually know in real life, but the online community of that really gave me a wider perspective of racing and of the community itself, beyond all my travels as an announcer and, you know, knowing riders all over the world, the country. It's and the repeated theme is that the new riders that come in want to know, A, can I go, or how fast do I have to be able to go to hang in with the pack? I'm about to enter a race. I've averaged about 25 miles an hour on my own. That's their concern is, what's the speed going to be, and can I do it and not get dropped and get humiliated? And then the other one is, you know, how do I not crash and take out half the fields? Those are the two things that they're coping with the most is, you know, competing at or being at the level of everybody else and, you know, self-preservation, I think. So by the time they're Category 3, yeah, they've learned a lot about not crashing, but have they learned, now it's that next level of strategy. How do I get my teammate, or how does my teammate get me to the line before everybody else?
Well, and that brings me to one of the examples you use as an analogy between a Firebird and a Thunderbird.
Yeah.
To sort of illustrate the difference in the types of riders. Tell me more about that, because I think that's illustrating that will illustrate the kind of the depth of the book and all the different things you do discuss.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Well, it's my analogy, so of course it's good. It's a good analogy to use, because we all come to the line with a fancy bicycle and all the same kit, and we all have, you know, body styles are different. But we're all different, not just in the physiological makeup of having fast twitch and slow twitch muscles, and some guys can go are stronger for longer, and some guys are sprinters. You know, the Firebird is the Pontiac Firebird we're talking about is you know, a more sporty car than a Thunderbird, which is a little bit heavier, a little more luxurious. It's a little bit slower off the line and just guzzled gas. Those analogies still hold up in racing because you know, I'm a sprinter. And for me to go up a hill is, you know, it's like Mark Cavendish. Let's use him as a better example. He's a sprinter. Getting
right.
him to the top of a hill or getting him in a time trial, it's just he just looks out of place and he feels out of place and he knows he's out of place. It's recognizing that and knowing what your talents are and playing your talents, knowing what your weaknesses are and working to them, but knowing that, you know, there's physiological limitations of, you know, if you're just not built to be a sprinter, then get out of the way during the sprint. Don't try to mix it up. And try to win the race some other way, or contribute your talents to your team in some other way. And I think one of the examples I use is Chris Huber. Chris Huber has no sprint at all. If he's sprinting in Chicago, he has to start winding it up in Nebraska. And that's a long way out.
It is a long way out there.
Yeah, but knowing that, then how do you use that in a race?
Sure.
Well, you know, you attack with 3 laps to go, and everyone says, you're never going to last.
Right, but of course he's got the endurance and not the sprint.
Right, exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. I got
it. That works. And as long as you've got the element of surprise and nobody knows that you're a Chris Huber type, you might be able to use it 3 or 4 times before everybody catches on to you. So,
I'm speaking with Jamie Smith. He is the author of a new book by Velo Press called Reading the Race, along with champion and I think maybe soon to be retired, unfortunately, Chris Horner. At last I heard he did not have a team for 2014. Is that true?
I don't know. I've only heard a rumor that, and it was completely unsubstantiated that another team was interested in him. But when, if you haven't heard that rumor, then I'm not gonna.
I don't know, and I hope it's true. I think of Chris Horner kind of as a gentleman of the sport.
Yes. Yep. And I don't know what else to say about that. He's he's always been one of my favorite riders. And let's back up, because we talked about how we got him involved in the project. One of the reasons I wanted to get him in this project, and Velo Press as well, is we want him to write a book of his own, because he's got a fantastic story. From, as he alludes to in the book, traveling with the Trent and the Klasner brothers, living in a van, living the dream, to winning the Vuelta and all the things in between. He's went to Europe, came back, kind of failed, decided that he had to go back. Those kinds of, that's a really compelling story that we kind of want him to write. And hopefully we'll get him to do so.
Isn't he the rider that, like, carried somebody across the line?
Yeah, Bill, I think it was Bill DeMong, in Cascade or somewhere, this Cascade Classic or somewhere like that. He's done that kind of stuff. And, that's the personality that the people are drawn to. So.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see a book from him. But in the meantime, he has a lot of good stuff to say in this book. So, it's interesting reading, if nothing else, even if, like for me, I'm not getting in a Peloton anytime soon.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about off-season, because now it's off-season. What are you saying for bike racers right now about off-season? What is it that they should be thinking about for the 2014 season?
Well, the two takeaways from this book, the biggest one is learning how to conserve your energy in the pack. That's the golden rule of cycling, is to don't burn your matches when you don't need to. But the other one is, and it's kind of, we didn't hit on it very hard, but it's counter steering and learning how to handle the bike by counter steering. And if that's a skill that you don't, if you've never heard that phrase before, or if you don't know what it means, that's a scientific principle of physics that you have to, as a bike racer, have to know and have to master to really handle that bike. And that'll get you, that will propel you to the front of the class no matter what. So counter steering is the art of turning the bike is done through counter steering. If I want the bike to go to the right around a right hand turn, push the bars to the left.
Right.
So I put pressure on the right hand handlebar and physically push that, turn the wheel a little bit to the left, and that starts the process. Making that instinctive and making that not as a second nature, just habit, like I said, mastering it, will help your bike racing and your pack riding and just your riding in general to know how that works. And I am astounded. Like I said, I have a lot of conversations with riders, especially when I was starting to write this book, just to see how much people knew and how much they, what they knew and what they didn't know. And that was one that I always came back to of, managing yourself in a pack, especially on a criterium course with several corners. And you can spot it in a rider when everybody else is cutting a nice, smooth arc, and they're all following that same arc.
Right.
You can spot the rider who is scalloping. He's just kind of like turn, and oh, we made it. It's like,
or not.
Or not, right.
Exactly.
So in the off season, you asked another long answer. If you want to work on something this winter, it's bike handling and counter steering and learning that concept. And if you already know it, then you can take the rest of the winter off.
Oh, okay. And just eat lots of food.
Exactly.
So do you believe in riding rollers? Just out of curiosity.
I have some. I don't like them. I'm a cross-country skier, a speed skater, and snowshoeing. I'll do anything I can.
Not to ride the rollers. I got it.
Yeah.
Well, my last question to you isn't really a question. Do you have a really cool story from one of your races that you could, that you announced that you could tell?
The whole is a story in itself. And it's that we have this, it's a collection of stories. We have this network of friends that we don't even know about that covers the country. And we can go into any town and any place and any, go to any big shop and find out where the ride is. And you've got brothers and sisters there that you don't even know. And they're it's like this secret organization that we have. And so most of my stories are more about the travel and the lifestyle. I mean, I've got plenty of stories to tell as an announcer and seeing weird stuff and, you know, weird stuff happening. And the one that pops to mind is, well, speaking of Cleveland, it was the old Revco race.
Oh.
You remember on was it Cleveland's campus?
It is, the Cleveland State campus downtown, yep.
This was just a rare moment that about three of us all together saw at the same time. There was a crash on the home stretch, and Herb Meingast, who from the Meingast family,
right,
of cyclists, he came disengaged from his pedals and his handlebars and went airborne and then landed back on his bike and kept riding.
Oh, my goodness.
All three of us saw it, and we all, it was after the race, we were all telling stories, and we're like, did you see that crash? Yeah. Did you see Herb Meingast? Yeah. Did you see? And it was, we all happened to be watching the same thing at the same time, and he literally came unattached with both feet, both hands and feet, went up in the air, and then landed on his bike, so those odd little things, yeah, I've got a million of those. And
you know what? Maybe you need to write another book.
Well, that's Roadie, which came out in 2008.
Oh, that's right. You already wrote that book.
Well, that started out, I don't know how much time we have, but I'll try to make this quicker than all the other ones. That started out as just a collection of all those stupid stories of little things like that that I saw or was part of, or the time we were riding a club ride, and we went through a swarm of bees, and we all got stung.
Ugh.
And from then on, we were called the Bee Group for an entirely different reason that is, you know, usually applied to that.
Right.
So I got all those little stories I was just trying to write down and file them away and, you know, put them somewhere, and it morphed into a different project, and then it became a book, and then it became Roadie. So, and a lot of those stories subsequently were cut because they didn't fit the tone of the book. And I can come back to that and save it because, yeah, you're right. After 25 or 30 years in the sport, you start to see a lot of weird things.
Well, it's been really fun. Dave told me you would be a lot of fun to have a conversation with, and you have been. The book is Reading the Race. It's by Velo Press, Jamie Smith and Chris Horner. It is out now. You can order it from Amazon and all kinds of different places online. Well, Jamie, have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday, and maybe we'll talk again soon, yeah?
I appreciate it.
All right.
I look forward to the races.
Okay. Bye-bye. Jamie Smith joined me from his home in Detroit. As I was told, he's a character, and what an interesting conversation. The book is good. It is Reading the Race. It's by Velo Press. Well, I hope you enjoyed the show this week. It is Thanksgiving week coming up. I hope you have a very happy Thanksgiving, a safe one. And if you eat a lot, go out for a ride. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.